pull up a chair. I want you to hear an engine first. Not a smooth one, a big rotary, a French motor spinning the whole engine block around with a propeller, throwing castor oil back into a man's face until his goggles were slick with it and his stomach turned. That smell, hot oil, burnt fuel, doped fabric baking in the sun, that's the world this story starts in. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. Today we're going to talk about a man who was told more than once that he didn't belong in an airplane. Too old, too uneducated, too much of a mechanic and not enough of a gentleman, and he went on to become the greatest American fighter pilot of the First World War. Then he nearly died a nobody, floating on a rubber raft in the middle of the Pacific, 22 years later. His name was Eddie Rickenbacker. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And believe me, the fellow we're talking about today earned every coin they never got to make for him. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let's go back. Edward Rickenbacker was born in Columbus, Ohio in 1890, son of Swiss immigrants. His father died when Eddie was 12, and that was the end of school. He went to work. Glassworks, a foundry, a shoe factory, a monument yard carving headstones, a boy doing a man's labor because the family needed the money on the table. But here's where it gets interesting. What saved Eddie Rickenbacker was speed. He fell in love with the automobile back when the automobile was a rich man's toy and a poor man's death trap. He taught himself engines. Really taught himself the way you only learn a thing when nobody's around to explain it to you. And by his early 20s, Eddie Rickenbacker was one of the most famous race car drivers in America. He raced at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He set a land speed record at Daytona Beach, better than 134 miles an hour on sand, in a machine with no seatbelt and no roll cage and brakes that were more of a suggestion than a promise. They called him Fast Eddie. He was earning $40,000 a year at a time when a working man was glad to see $1,000, so he knew engines. He knew speed. He knew what it felt like to hold a machine together with his hands and his nerve at the ragged edge of control, where a half second of hesitation kills you. Remember that? It matters later. Then, 1917, America goes to war. Rickenbacker wanted to fly. Everybody young and brave wanted to fly, but the Air Service wanted college men. Gentlemen fellows who'd road crew at Yale and could quote poetry. And here's Eddie, 26 years old, which was ancient for a fighter pilot, a grease under the fingernails race mechanic with no diploma. They told him no. So he found the side door. He shipped over to France as a staff driver, a chauffeur for the senior officers, and he made himself useful in a way only he could. When Billy Mitchell's staff car broke down on a French road, it was Sergeant Rickenbacker who fixed it. He made friends with the men who could make things happen. He lobbied, he pestered, and finally, they led him into flight training. Now picture the airplane, the Newport 28 first, then later the SPAD 13, wood and wire and fabric, an open cockpit, no parachute, because the brass back home thought a parachute might tempt a pilot to jump instead of fight. Let that sit with you a moment. They sent these boys up with no way down. The guns were two Vickers machine guns firing through the propeller arc, timed by a gear so the bullets slipped between the spinning blades. When they timed wrong, and they did, a man shot his own propeller off at altitude. The cold up high was savage. Frostbite on your cheeks. Fingers so numb you could barely work the trigger. And every single flight, you flew knowing that the fellow coming the other way wanted nothing in this world so much as to set you on fire. Rickenbacker joined the 94th Aero Squadron. The Hat in the Ring Squadron, they called it, for the insignia they painted on the fuselage, Uncle Sam's Stars and Stripes top hat sitting inside a ring. First American squadron to fly combat patrols over the lines, and Eddie, the old man, the mechanic they almost didn't let in, turned out to be a natural killer in the air. But not reckless. Here's the thing that separated him. All that racing had taught him something the young hotshots hadn't learned yet. The ones who charged in swinging and got themselves shot down in their first week. Rickenbacker was patient, he was calculating. He studied the enemy the way he'd studied a race course. He'd hang back, watch, pick his moment, and strike from a position where the odds were his. He understood energy and angles and altitude before anybody was using those words. He treated air combat like a machine to be understood, not a duel to be romanced. He scored his first victory in April of 1918, and then the tally climbed. Now, in the middle of all this, his body nearly took him out of the fight. An ear infection. A mastoid abscess grounded him for weeks. He came back to find younger men had passed him on the scoreboard, and instead of that breaking him, it lit a fire. There's a day I want to tell you about. September 25th, 1918. Rickenbacker's up alone on a morning patrol near the front, and he spots seven German aircraft. Seven. Five Fokkers flying top cover and two of the big two-seat observation planes below them. One man against seven, and nobody would ever have known if he'd just turned around and gone home for breakfast. He didn't. He climbed into the sun, that old trick, using the glare to hide, and he dove, hit the two-seaters before the escort even knew he was there. Flamed one, scattered the rest, twisted through the whole furious mess of it, and came out the other side alive with two of them down. For that morning's work, one American against a formation of seven, they gave him the Medal of Honor, though he didn't actually receive it until years later, in 1930, from President Hoover himself. By the time the guns went silent on November 11, 1918, Eddie Rickenbacker had 26 confirmed aerial victories, more than any other American pilot in the war, America's ace of aces. The race mechanic, they said, was too old and too common to fly, had beaten every gentleman in the service. Now, a lot of hangar stories would end right there. Roll the credits. But I told you at the top, the most incredible part of this man's life happened 24 years after the war, and it had nothing to do with shooting anybody down. October 1942. The Second World War now. Rickenbacker's a civilian, in his 50s, running Eastern Airlines and serving as a special envoy for the War Department. The Army sends him on a secret tour of the Pacific to inspect operations and carry a confidential message to General MacArthur. They put him aboard a B-17, a flying fortress, as a passenger, flying from Hawaii out toward a tiny speck of an island for refueling. And the navigation goes wrong. The instruments are off. They miss the island. They fly and they fly over an ocean that has no landmarks, no roads, nothing but water in every direction to the curve of the earth, until the fuel gauge is read empty, and the pilot has to set that big bomber down in the open sea. They ditched. Eight men scrambled out into three little rubber life rafts, lashed together, before the fortress sank, and then the Pacific just had them. No food to speak of, a few oranges gone in days, almost no water. The tropical sun by day cooking them, blistering their skin, cracking their lips, the cold by night setting them shivering. Sharks, big ones, bumping the rafts, sliding along underneath close enough to touch. Saltwater sores, delirium, and no one anywhere knew where they were because they'd gone down miles from where anybody was looking. Rickenbacker, the oldest man aboard by far, became the spine of that little band. He was hard, grumpy, some of them said later, downright mean when he needed to be. He rode the younger men, cussed at them, kept them furious enough at him that they stayed alive out of pure stubbornness. He'd been to the edge of death so many times in a race car and an airplane that he simply refused to accept it out there on the water. There's a moment in this story that people have told and retold, and Rickenbacker swore to it his whole life. About the eighth day, they'd finished a little prayer, a reading from a testament one of the men carried, asking for something to eat, and a seagull out of the empty sky, hundreds of miles from any land, came and landed right on Rickenbacker's head. He sat dead still, reached up slow, and he caught it. They ate that bird, and they used its innards for bait to catch a little fish. Believe what you want about how that gull got there. Those men believed it saved their lives day after day. The rafts drifting, men weakening. One of them, a young pilot, finally died and they slipped him over the side, and still Rickenbacker would not let the rest of them quit. 24 days. 24 days on the open Pacific in a rubber raft. When a Navy float plane finally spotted them, Rickenbacker had lost 60 pounds off a frame that didn't have it to give. The newspapers back home had already run his obituary. They'd buried Fast Eddie in print, and here he came, back from the dead again, carried off that raft alive. Now here's what I want you to take home from all this. We love our aces for the shooting. 26 victories, the Medal of Honor, hat in the ring, all of it, and it's a magnificent record. But that's not really what made Eddie Rickenbacker. What made him was on that raft. It was the same thing that made him in the race car and in the Newport. A man who had decided somewhere down deep that he was not going to be beaten by the machine or the weather or the ocean or the odds. Patience when other men panicked, calculation when other men prayed and gave up. And a flat, mule-headed refusal to die on somebody else's schedule. He lived to be 82 years old, died in 1973. A poor Ohio boy with no diploma who outflew the gentleman, outlasted the Pacific, and built one of the great airlines of this country in between. They told him he was too old to fly. 26 times over enemy lines, they were proven wrong, my thanks today, to the National Air and Space Museum and to Rickenbacker's own memoirs, which are worth every hour. If you can find a copy, for keeping the details of this one straight. If you want the pictures, the hat and the ring insignia, that old spad, you can find your way to us at RadioHangar.com. Next time you think you've come to flying too late, or you're too ordinary, or the odds are stacked too high, you think about a grease-stained race driver eating a seagull off his own head in the middle of the ocean and refusing to quit. This is Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.